Support for UpToDate is provided by Geisinger, providing world-class care for our community, here, where it matters.
Hello and welcome to UpToDate from WVIA News. I'm Sarah Cinto, here to keep you caught up with all the news you should know about. The United States' recent Olympic gold medal in women's hockey drove dozens of girls to try hockey over the weekend. We'll take the ice with them in Wilkes-Barre. And how can wildlife corridors help Pennsylvania's animals travel safely between habitats? It's Wednesday, March 11th. Let's get you up to date. Let's get right on the ice today. Following the U.S. women's hockey team gold medal at the Winter Olympics, more than 60 girls ages 4 to 18 tried hockey this weekend. They learned to pass and shoot and handle hockey sticks alongside coaches and volunteers from the Wilkes-Barre Junior Pens. As WVIA's Kat Bolas reports, the free event had an overwhelming but welcome amount of girls sign up.
Bobby Fidelli is a coach for the Junior Pens. She says one goal of Saturday's event was to get enough girls interested in the sport to have a full roster for a girls' team. Right now, the Junior Pens have co-ed travel teams.
Hockey is growing in Pennsylvania, and we want girls to be a part of that.
Fidelli says the last time the organization held a girls' try hockey for free clinic, 25 girls signed up.
Just seeing this overwhelming response and having to open up registration for extra people, even though we don't really have enough equipment, was really overwhelming and just a great thing to see.
Aniston Yoder is 14. 4 years ago, she picked up skates and a hockey stick at the frozen pond at Hillside Park in South Abington Township. Now she plays wing for a Junior Pens co-ed team.
It's great seeing all these girls come together and just become like one family, one team, but we really need a girls team, so this is great.
The Mahaffey sisters from Sugarloaf Township were on the ice. Abby is the youngest. She says it was her first time skating, but she wants to be a hockey player when she grows up.
I mean, sometime when I get better at this.
In Wilkes-Barre, I'm Kat Bolas, WVIA News.
Thanks, Kat. Find more of that story, including photos, at WVIA.org. Now let's look a little more statewide. Plans are in the works for a number of Pennsylvania agencies to collaborate on recommendations for wildlife corridors. As Ann Danahy reports for WVIA, environmental organizations are applauding the move towards statewide habitat planning.
Cindy Adams Dunn is secretary of the Pennsylvania Department of Conservation and Natural Resources. She said during a recent state budget hearing that they'll be bringing together various departments to look at what can be done to create corridors that connect fragmented habitats.
These corridors are also good for climate resiliency. As the climate changes, all kinds of plants, animals, biota need pathways to move safely. So it's much bigger than simply wildlife crossing.
Stephanie Wine is the clean water and conservation advocate at Penn Environment. She says wildlife connectivity could involve a crossing under a roadway, but also land preservation or private landowners planting native species. Wine says statewide planning will benefit both Pennsylvania's native species and drivers' road safety.
It's just so exciting that we are going to have that sort of 10,000-foot view, collaborative interagency approach to creating wildlife corridors and wildlife crossings and addressing habitat fragmentations.
Wine says, as it is now, this type of work can be catch-as-catch-can.
What if we actually, ahead of time, took a real look at what are the hotspots that where we need to do habitat connectivity work?
Dunn says the effort will involve local governments, private landowners, and conservation groups, along with state agencies. It follows a study by Penn Environment and bipartisan legislation in a state report on addressing habitat fragmentation. In State College, I'm Ann Danahy.
Stay with us. There's more Up to Date after this break.
You know WVIA as your arts, news, and information station. It's time to add local sports to the list. Get ready for Sports Voices, a new feature where we partner with Fox 56 TV sports director Bob Ide to discuss the latest local sports news from around Northeast and Central Pennsylvania. We'll look ahead to the week's key games in high school sports, collegiate athletics, and more. Tune in to WVIA-FM at 7:51 and 9:51 a.m. every Friday morning.
Welcome back. So, just a warning, the sound you're about to hear might be a little annoying. It's the sound of the pesky, annoying horsefly that warns us all, stay still and you might get bit. But even more destructive is a particular silent fly that arrived on our shores about 250 years ago, around the same time Thomas Jefferson wrote the Declaration of Independence in Philadelphia. As part of an occasional series on the anniversary of the nation's signature document, Susan Phillips reports for WVIA on how one of the country's first invasive species spurred suspicions of biological warfare, threatened the new nation's economy, and inspired citizen science.
We're going back to 1776. In August of that year, thousands of German soldiers known as Hessians arrived in America to fight against the Continental Army. Paid by the British, the Hessians sparked fear and resentment among the colonists, helping to rally more Americans to the cause. These soldiers were so hated, they were named as one of 27 grievances listed in the Declaration of Independence, condemned for raping and pillaging farmers throughout New Jersey. Around the same time, a new pest began to eat wheat, barley, and rye crops on American farms. The pest was a tiny white worm, sort of like a maggot, which munched its way to adulthood, destroying the harvest before flying off to mate in other fields.
It began in Long Island and Brooklyn, and they could sit and watch as the insect moved further west and further south.
Lou Mazur is a professor of American history at Rutgers University. Mazur says the fly, which is the size of a gnat, worried farmers, many of whom, like Thomas Jefferson, were also delegates to the Continental Congress.
They are concerned, deeply concerned, because wheat is critical, not only to domestic production, but to export.
Rumors spread that the fly hitched a ride, some thought on purpose, through the straw bedding of Hessian soldiers. While it could have happened this way, there is no evidence this is how the fly arrived, or that it was a piece of biological warfare employed by the Hessians or the British. But the story stuck. After the war, a gentleman farmer and slave owner from Princeton, New Jersey, named George Morgan, looked out over his devastated crops and decided the pest needed a name. In fact, a very bad name. Morgan explains here in a letter that he wanted everyone to associate the destruction and violence by Hessian soldiers with the devastation wrought by the fly.
The name of the Hessian fly was given to this insect by myself. We agreed to use some industry in spreading the name to add, if possible, to the detestation in which the human and insect were generally held by our yeomanry, and to hand it down with all possible infamy to the next generation as a useful national prejudice.
So it's a very powerful piece of rhetorical propaganda out of the rage that the revolutionaries felt of those 30,000 Hessian soldiers who fought for the British during the war.
Morgan also wrote to George Washington that year telling him the fly had reached Philadelphia. He describes in detail his experiments to save his crop. That same year, Britain banned wheat imports from our young nation because of the Hessian fly. Thomas Jefferson was furious, calling it a libel on our wheat and saying it was in retaliation for America winning the war. Jefferson soon got involved as a member of the American Philosophical Society, which spearheaded scientific research into the Hessian fly. The society, created by Benjamin Franklin in 1743, still exists today in a faux colonial building near Independence Mall.
Let's see what I have here.
It's here where millions of colonial-era documents are stored.
So I want to show you two, just so you can see. These are the official APS minutes from 1787 to 1793.
Adriana Link is the History of Science curator at the American Philosophical Society. She opens a sheepskin-bound volume with elaborate handwritten cursive script on parchment.
These are really incredible accounts that represent the conversations that would have been happening at the society during the time. So here, this is an entry from April 15th, 1791. On motion of Mr. Jefferson, resolved that a select committee be appointed to collect and communicate to the society materials for forming the natural history of the insect usually called the Hessian fly.
In 1791, Jefferson and James Madison set out on an expedition. Traveling through New Jersey and New York to survey farmers, they asked these ordinary Americans to observe and document their experiences with the Hessian fly, which threatened the new nation's economy. While they didn't get the amount of responses they expected, Link says their attempts at citizen science was a uniquely American, as opposed to British, way to solve the problem.
So that, I think, is distinct, too. There's this kind of optimism in the power of collective scientific work.
Link says Jefferson's obsession with the fly was twofold: serious risks to the nation's budding independent economy, and pride that American science, or what was then referred to as natural history, could be just as effective as European.
I think Jefferson being sort of the driving force in this is telling, because he did see science as being a mechanism through which to build the nation.
By 1811, the Hessian fly had traveled south to Thomas Jefferson's fields at Monticello, destroying one-third of his wheat crop. Today, the consensus is the fly was never even in Germany. The Hessian fly originated in the Fertile Crescent in North Africa and the Middle East, the same place where wheat originated. And today, it's still here. The pest is manageable, but still one of the most devastating to the country's wheat. The tiny larvae emerge at the base of the plant several times a year, and in some areas of the country, climate change could be making it worse. The solutions today aren't that different than they were 250 years ago. Find and develop more resistant strains of wheat, and time fall planting to avoid egg laying. Almost 250 years later, everyone, scientists and farmers alike, still call it the Hessian fly. So the Princeton farmer George Morgan would be happy to know that he succeeded in passing down his
useful national prejudice.
From the Climate Desk, I'm Susan Phillips, WHYY News.
All right, I hope you're feeling up to date. Find more stories at WVIA.org. I'm Sarah Cinto. Thanks for joining me today. If you want to stay in the know, make sure you subscribe and listen every weekday wherever you get your podcasts. Have a great day, everyone. I'll catch you tomorrow, right here on Up to Date.